to even breathe clean air. So our fight for climate justice is indeed a fight for human rights, and we cannot have climate justice without ensuring that the rights of the people are protected.
Final words to this global audience that is listening to everything you say?
Well, it's very hard, you know, to find words to say when you know what is happening, especially in the negotiations and what is happening at the COP. But what I hope is that our leaders, you know, can inspire us with action. I hope that our leaders can inspire us with true climate leadership.
Well, Vanessa Nakate, I think you've shown what leadership looks like.
Thank you.
We thank you very much for being with us. And again, happy, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Vanessa Nakate, climate justice activist, speaking to us. She usually is in Uganda. She's the author of her memoir, A Bigger Picture, My Fight to Bring a New African Voice to the Climate Crisis. And that does it for our show. By the way, Juan Gonzalez will be giving a speech Friday at the Columbia School of Journalism, reflecting on his 40 years of fighting for racial and social justice in journalism. It begins at 4:10 p.m. on Friday. See democracynow.org for more information. A very special thanks to our colleagues here in Sharm el-Sheikh, to Hani Massoud, to Sharif Abdelkaddous, Dennis Moynihan, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
Many people ask me what my show, Radio Lost and Found, is about, and I tell them it's about 1 hour 58 minutes. Radio Lost and Found is a 2-hour media scape of found sounds, forgotten records, outre recordings, and more, coming to you every second and fourth Thursday from 10 to midnight, right here on KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Andrea Salinas clinches the win in Oregon's new 6th Congressional District. The Bureau of Land Management reverses a Trump-era rule that expanded post-fire logging in Oregon. And in international news, Israel's new governing party seems poised to return the country to more conservative ways. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 15th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. Democrat Andrea Salinas has won the race for Oregon's new 6th Congressional District. This makes her the first Latina congresswoman to represent Oregon in Congress, along with Lori Chavez de Remer in Oregon's 5th District. The race was called by the Associated Press and the Oregonian on Monday night. It was the last of the state's 6 congressional districts to be called, and Salinas won by at least 6,000 votes. Salinas defeated Republican Mike Erickson, leaving 4 of Oregon's seats in the hands of Democrats and 2 of those seats in the hands of Republicans. Salinas said late Monday after her win, quote, "My dad came to the United States from Mexico in 1950 and worked in the fields picking cotton and tomatoes before he was in first grade." She continued, quote, "It's my family's stories that made me believe change is possible in a single generation, but only if we work for it. I can't promise that change will come easily, but I can promise that no matter who you vote for or what lies ahead, I will be your champion, always. It's the honor of my lifetime to be your congresswoman-elect," end quote. A power plant in Oregon has opened with solar, wind, and battery storage on site. It's the first facility of its kind to feature all three. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
A first-of-its-kind hybrid power plant with wind, solar, and battery storage has opened in Oregon. The plant could be a model as power grids across the country decarbonize. The Wheat Ridge Renewable Energy Facility is a partnership between Portland General Electric and NextEra Energy Resources and is located in Lexington, about 30 miles south of the Columbia River in central Oregon. Brett Sims with PGE says the facility will go a long way toward achieving Oregon's ambitious climate goals.
That's a generating facility that literally has the capability to serve 100,000 households, which is roughly the equivalent of the energy requirements of a city the size of Salem or Eugene. So when we add those types of facilities, that's a big needle mover.
Under a law passed last year, Oregon utilities are required to reduce carbon emissions by 100% by 2040. It's one of the most ambitious climate goals in the nation. Jason Berwin with the American Clean Power Association says the sun doesn't always shine when the wind is blowing, and vice versa. That's why this hybrid facility will look as if it is one resource with consistent output. He says one of the biggest challenges to wind and solar at the moment is a lack of transmission lines.
Folks are trying to find efficiencies for how to get more resources online faster, and hybridizing them, putting them all together at one site, can help speed up that process.
Berwin says we can build solar, wind, and storage faster than any other clean resource. He adds that 2040 might seem far away, but building will have to start today to move utilities away from fossil fuel sources by then.
To meet a fully decarbonized power system requires us to build more wind and solar and storage than we ever have before at a pace that is greater than we have ever done before.
Support for this reporting was provided by Solutions Journalism Network. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
A Trump-era rule that allowed major logging projects after a wildfire without environmental review will be overturned. The Bureau of Land Management had a new rule as of 2020 that increased the amount of acres that could be logged after a wildfire without doing an environmental review. Before that rule, it was 250 acres. After the rule, it got bumped up to 3,000. The purported logic behind the rule is that after a wildfire, there are still potentially trees to be logged that survived, and since the environment just went through a major event, cutting down the trees didn't matter. Oregon environmental groups sued the federal agency over this rule change, saying they didn't have justification to increase the acreage by that much. They also pointed out how important remaining trees and shrubbery are to the environment after a wildfire. They say they help slow erosion and keep sediment from overwhelming waterways. They say that watersheds fresh off a wildfire are delicate, and building roads to log new areas doesn't help. Environmental advocates also voiced the risk of logging on animal species, like the threatened northern spotted owl. Now the Bureau of Land Management says they will return to their old advisory. Any more than 250 acres logged post-fire will require an environmental review. President Biden says he doesn't think that Democrats have the votes to codify abortion rights, but they may have enough to codify same-sex marriage. With more on the story, it's Catherine Carley with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
I don't think there's enough votes to codify unless something happens unusual in the House. I think we're going to get very close in the House, but I think it's going to be very close, but I don't think we're going to make it.
President Joe Biden says Democrats will likely not have the votes needed to codify abortion rights following the Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Several states rejected efforts to restrict access to abortion during midterm elections.
Providing the certainty is really important. The ability to protect your family through the legal means that accompany marriage is critical to folks.
The Senate is expected to vote this week on legislation led by Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin to codify same-sex marriage. A first vote on the bill could happen as early as Wednesday. Democrats will keep the Senate, but Scott Wong of NBC News says control of the House will take longer to determine.
Democrats really have defied history here because of the slow count in California, where a lot of these uncalled races are. We may not know for days, perhaps even weeks.
19 races remain undecided. Republicans need to win at least 6 seats, while Democrats need at least 14. More than 60 Republicans, including former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, say party leadership elections should be delayed until after Georgia's Senate runoff next month.
It's 4 votes that control this town.
Trump himself is expected to announce his presidential intentions today. Arizona GOP Chairwoman Kelly Ward thought the Democrats were up to no good on Election Day 2020.
You know, we're looking at everything because there's a lot of funny business going on out there.
Now the House committee investigating the January 6th attack could find out how Ward responded. The Supreme Court denied efforts by Ward to block the committee's subpoena seeking her phone records. Committee members believe Ward played a key role in efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election.
And we know that the administration knows of Peltier's clemency request, and we're going to continue to press and raise awareness until Peltier is granted clemency.
Rachel Thunder of the American Indian Movement says a more than 1,100-mile spiritual walk from Minneapolis to Washington, D.C. helped raise awareness of efforts to free Leonard Peltier, who has served more than 46 years in prison following the murder of two FBI agents at Wounded Knee in 1975. Peltier is 78 and in poor health.
Just need a moment to thank God. Breathe a sigh of relief.
Finally, University of Virginia Police Chief Timothy Longo Sr., after a student gunman who fatally shot three members of the school's football team and wounded two others, was taken into custody. The Gun Violence Archive shows nearly 600 mass shootings in the U.S. this year so far. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
It's Lung Cancer Awareness Month, raising awareness for a disease that's estimated to kill 130,000 people in the U.S. this year. Mike Moen has more.
November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month, bringing the spotlight to the country's deadliest form of cancer. There will be an estimated 130,000 lung cancer deaths in 2022, including nearly 2,000 in Minnesota, that according to the American Cancer Society. Michael Skokin is a pulmonary critical care physician at the Oregon Clinic. He says many of these deaths are preventable, and the first action people can take is to stop smoking. Skokin says the disease historically has presented some challenges to doctors.
When you find it at an early stage, you can treat it. But over the years, we hadn't been good at doing that because people don't really have symptoms. And once they have symptoms, it's usually a later stage and it's spread and it's much, much more difficult to treat. And sometimes it's not treatable.
Skokin says people who haven't yet quit and meet certain criteria are able to get screened for the cancer with a CT scan of their lungs. The scan helps doctors identify early-stage lung cancers, and the tool has been around for about a decade. COVID-19 has had an effect on lung health, but no direct link with cancer. However, Skokin says the pandemic did affect treatment, with many people avoiding the doctor's office.
People who got other things during that time when everything was really problematic in getting care, that affected a lot of people who didn't necessarily have COVID but got other things, including lung disease or lung cancer, and couldn't get treated as timely as we had been able to do in the past.
And while the number of deaths is still high, Skokin notes it has been going down in recent years for a few reasons.
Number one, less people smoking. So we're starting to see the effects of that. And the other thing is that our treatments are getting better. So people who present with lung cancer, we now have more options for treatment, and people are living longer.
Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
The Cherokee Nation is calling on Congress to honor its commitment to offer them a non-voting delegate in the legislature. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Cherokee Nation is calling on Congress to honor a commitment made by the U.S. government in the 1800s to see a non-voting delegate from the Cherokee Nation in the U.S. House of Representatives. Cherokee Nation citizen Kim Teehee has been chosen as the delegate. Rhonda Lovaldo recently spoke with her about a national campaign started by the Oklahoma tribe to get her seated.
Kim Teehee, Cherokee Nation citizen, has served as senior policy advisor for Native American affairs during the Obama administration, and she feels that not only would she represent her nation, but all nations across Indian country.
Cherokee Nation is the direct recipient of being my one constituent, the government, Cherokee Nation, right? But I'm mindful of the fact that Indian country has too few advocates. As it is. You know, we have 4 Native Americans now, 1 Native Hawaiian, 1 Alaska Native, and that's 6 total, right? And so, given my background and my experiences, having served as a Hill staffer for so many years, I do think I bring that expertise to the table.
When talking about if and when she'll be appointed, Teehee feels it will be done this year. And if not, the Cherokee Nation will cross that bridge when the time comes. She pointed out all the Native women leaders that are making history now and feels the time is right.
The stars are aligned to get this done. I don't think it's avoidable. You know, if it doesn't happen this year, we'll keep fighting. But I think the stars are aligned to get it done. I just think we've broken the glass ceiling too many times of having the first Native cabinet official, having the first U.S. treasurer be Native, having the first astronaut, you know, living in a space station be Native, you know, and having the most Native Americans at a single time serving in the Congress. It's pretty remarkable.
Teehee says the United States should honor their words and treaties, especially the long overdue commitment to see a Cherokee Nation delegate in the U.S. House of Representatives. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
Organizers behind an effort to assist indigenous voters at the polls in last week's election in North Dakota say there were some issues people encountered when casting their ballot. Mike Moen has more.
The Native American Rights Fund, or NARF, worked with groups such as North Dakota Native Vote to station trained poll watchers at various sites. NARF staff attorney Michael Carter says there were situations, for example, where a voter had issues tied to the state's ID law.
There were, in fact, some Native voters being turned away improperly, and the matter was able to be corrected. The voters were able to come back and vote and have their votes counted.
North Dakota Native Vote says it saw only one instance of a voter not returning to complete the process. Carter says ahead of the election, they met with the Secretary of State to make sure all parties were on the same page in handling these matters. He says it's vital for the state to detail these instances in reports between elections as part of a consent decree that stemmed from challenges to the ID law. This election was the first since the state's latest redistricting process, in which two new state house subdistricts were created in tribal areas. In districts 4A and 9A, two Native candidates won their races. North Dakota Native Vote's Nicole Donaghy says these are strong examples of why tribal communities need more seats at the table when these voting maps are drawn.
We cannot elect our own people unless there's a focused effort to create a district that is majority Native American.
However, one of those newly created sub-districts is being challenged in court by the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, with leaders saying the lines still dilute the voting power of tribal members. Two incumbent state lawmakers with tribal roots, including Fargo-based Representative Ruth Buffalo, lost their re-election bids.
That was Mike Moen, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth look at the International Climate Summit COP27. We'll hear about what's been accomplished so far. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX, then at 7, Project Censored. Tonight's weather will be clear and windy with a low of 38 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will also be clear with a high of 52. Today in history, in 2022, the United Nations declares that the world population has officially reached 8 billion. The quote of the day is from the Roman statesman Cicero, who once said, quote, "If you have a garden and a library, you have everything you need." The film Without Water makes its debut this week. It focuses on the struggle between the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power and communities in the Long Valley to the southeast of Yosemite National Park. Suzanne Potter has more.
A new film about the transfer of water from the high desert to Los Angeles, called Without Water, has just been released on the internet. The film highlights the struggle between the community around Long Valley, which is between Mammoth and Bishop, and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power. The DWP has court permission to terminate long-standing water leases and limit irrigation water in Long and Little Round Valleys. But Matt McLean, with the Keep Long Valley Green Coalition, says that would endanger wildlife, fish, cattle grazing, tourism, and Native American cultural sites. So advocates are asking for at least 2.8 acre feet of water per year going forward.
We're trying to have dialogues with them to say, hey, look, this is the number that we think would be at a minimum equitable for you to supply ratepayers in Southern California while maintaining our wetlands up here.
In a statement, the LA DWP said it continues to provide water to ranchers in Mono County as it has historically done, and the amount of irrigation water is based on its operational needs and water conditions. The agency also asserted that L.A. is one of the most water-efficient cities in the world. Environmental groups say Mono County's water should not be used to maintain suburban landscaping. The agency bought up land and water rights in the Eastern Sierra back in the early 1900s. McLean says if the water flow is reduced, many of the area's native plants will give way to invasive cheatgrass, which will dry up in the summer and create a huge fire hazard.
That would be catastrophic. Certainly because there's the community of Crawley Lake and Hilton Creek right there, but also it could get so intense that it would burn that landscape and then destroy the seedbed and everything else with it. We could see that landscape not recover permanently.
The courts have ordered the DWP to do an environmental assessment before changing the water deliveries. The agency is expected to announce its plans early next year. The 21-minute film has won multiple awards at film festivals this year. It can now be streamed on the Keep Long Valley Green YouTube and Vimeo channels. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Israel has a new governing coalition after the most recent election, and it's more conservative. The person organizing the new government coalition is a familiar face, conservative leader Benjamin Netanyahu. KBOO's Josh Salem has the details on the country's more conservative turn.
Advocates for liberal policies are concerned Israel's incoming government will roll back many recent gains. Israel's outgoing coalition is the most diverse in the country's history, and it enacted a wide variety of progressive policies on the environment, LGBTQ+ protections, and issues related to the country's Arab minority. Israel's expected new coalition government is overwhelmingly male, religious, and right-wing. It promises to take back many of the achievements of its predecessor. For example, a tax on environmentally destructive single-use plastics could be abolished. New protections for gay Israelis could be eliminated, and funding for the Arab sector could be slashed. The outgoing coalition lasted for just over a year. It fell out of power largely over disagreements on the Palestinian situation. Its policies in that regard, however, were largely unchanged from previous hardline governments. With Benjamin Netanyahu set to take office again as head of what's expected to be the country's very right-wing government, activists fear much will be undone. The Association for LGBTQ Equality in Israel said previous public discourse entailed rights, equality, and ending discrimination, but now they expect, quote, a discourse of fear, end quote. Israel held elections on November 1st. These paved the way for Netanyahu's return, with support from ultra-nationalist and ultra-Orthodox allies. Netanyahu is expected to acquiesce to many of their conservative priorities, very different from those put forward by the outgoing government. Netanyahu has dismissed these concerns, saying they arise whenever he is elected, and that they are disproved quickly. The coalition that pushed Netanyahu out last year was comprised of 8 ideologically diverse parties, at least one of which supported Palestinian statehood. Included for the first time a small Arab Islamist party. The older coalition's health minister is openly gay, and about half of the members and a third of ministers were women. Its work did sidestep divisive topics such as Palestinian independence and was focused on social issues. The coalition imposed taxes on single-use plastics and advanced a climate law. The government also imposed a tax on sugary drinks and approved billions of dollars in funding to the country's Palestinian minority. It took steps to encourage religious pluralism, reforming the country's kosher certification processes. There were also major changes in regard to LGBTQ+ rights. The coalition rescinded a ban on blood donations by gay men, tried to streamline access to gender reassignment surgery, and took a stand opposing conversion therapy. The new coalition looks very different. Few are women, and in fact, about half of Netanyahu's expected coalition deny inclusion to women members altogether. The expected coalition includes no Arab members. Parliament might have one openly gay member, though his record shows no focus on LGBTQ+ issues. Incoming coalition members have already pinpointed policies they plan to undo, including the legality of pride parades. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Israel's new governing party means potential changes in policy. But how will the rest of the world react? Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. No one should be surprised to find Benjamin Netanyahu back as Prime Minister of Israel, with decisive support from far-right religious extremists. With the recent election, the religious bloc called Religious Zionism put Netanyahu's Likud party comfortably over the top in the Knesset, and now, as a leading member of the governing coalition, it is strongly positioned to pursue its volatile agenda aimed at reclaiming Israel as a Jewish state. Among things that might follow, based on their leaders' public statements, are the deportation of disloyal Palestinian citizens and legal challenges to Palestinian-owned buildings in the West Bank, restrictions on access to Al-Aqsa, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, sacred to both Jews and Palestinians, and massive changes in Israel's legal system pertaining to the selection of judges and the authority of the Supreme Court to overrule laws on constitutional grounds. This is obviously a very troubling development for U.S. policymakers and more generally for human rights advocates everywhere. Regrettably, the initial U.S. response, which came from the State Department spokesman, avoided direct comment on the extremists' takeover. Quote, "We hope that all Israeli government officials will continue to share the values of an open democratic society, including tolerance and respect for all in civil society, particularly for minority groups. You've heard us speak to the commitment we have to a future two-state solution and to equal measures of security, freedom, justice, and prosperity for Israelis and Palestinians alike." Sure. 2 years ago, Lahava, the virulent Israeli citizens group at the epicenter of armed attacks, race-mongering, and the incitement of terror against Palestinians, was inextricably bound up and politically enabled by Otzma Yehudit, translated as Jewish Power, an extremist right-wing political party that became a key player within Netanyahu's governing coalition. Otzma represents one of the factional players Netanyahu needed most to assure his political survival and, as important, to support a vote in the Knesset that would effectively eliminate pending legal charges against him in his trial on charges of breach of public trust and corruption. The voters of Israel have now spoken, and the Netanyahu government and Knesset will predictably veer to the extreme right, at least for the immediate future. Senator Robert Menendez, chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and one of Israel's most ardent and important political supporters, had reportedly warned Netanyahu about the adverse consequences for congressional support of bringing the extremist religious Zionism bloc into the government. His candid pre-election cautions apparently evoked the ire of Netanyahu, but they doubtless hit the mark. When these far-right groups first appeared in Netanyahu's governing coalition, the newly formed Biden administration was besieged with increasing fervor by voices on all sides of the unfolding tragedy. At that time, the president could have taken executive action to undermine Israeli extremism without the risk of fracturing his base or reputation at home or abroad. He could have asked the State Department to consider whether Lahava and Otzma should be added to the State Department's foreign terrorist organization list. It had been widely reported both in Israel and the U.S. that these organizations and their leaders had received support from U.S. donors through a cryptic network of religious and service organizations designed to provide cover as charitable institutions. Teruah, a leading American human rights organization representing 2,000 rabbis and cantors, filed a series of official complaints with the IRS documenting the abuse of the U.S. tax laws for so-called charitable contributions that ultimately went to support Lahava and Otzma. Putting an Israeli political organization on a U.S.-sponsored list geared to eliminating a tax exemption for the support of terrorist activities could be highly influential and well within the bounds of propriety. There is historic precedent for doing so. The legislation authorizing that move in 1996 was drafted by Ron Klain, then a lawyer serving in the Department of Justice, with support from then-Senator Biden. The president should consider taking this action now. While it is far from clear precisely how U.S. policymakers will express their opposition to Israeli extremism, whether indirectly through the foreign terrorist organization list or more directly through diplomatic or legislative means, most important is that the U.S. government deter terrorism sponsored by entities close to the heart of the incoming Israeli government. Those who rightly decry Palestinian terrorism need to take a hard look at what Israelis have just voted in, a coalition that has prominent advocates of violence against innocent Arab citizens. Doing so would give substance to U.S. support of human rights, not only in Israel, but in the Middle East generally. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, November 15th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth. We're taking a look at COP27.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Environmental activists are saying that the world leaders gathered in Egypt for the Conference of the Parties, or COP27 climate talks, are continuing to push false solutions to the climate crisis, such as technological carbon removal and carbon offsets. Basav Sen is the director of the Climate Policy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. He spoke with KPFA weekend news anchor and KBOO contributor David Rosenberg, who began by asking him if he thought anything positive had come out of the climate conference so far.
Certainly not at the level of governmental negotiations, but at the level of people's movements, yes, there's a lot of positive that has come out. I will get to that later, but let me start by talking about the official government negotiations. It may be a little premature to judge what comes out of it, given that